So our passage tonight is Daniel chapter 12, verses 5-13. And amongst other things then, our text this evening features two questions. And it's the second of those two questions that we're going to use this evening as our way into this passage. That question is found in verse 8. It is spoken by Daniel himself, and it goes like this: O my Lord, what shall be the outcome of these things? And there are three particular matters then that I want to consider this evening. And first of all, the meaning of the question. The meaning of the question. Now, there's a lot going on in verses 5 to 7 in the build-up to Daniel's question there in verse 8. And so let me try to unpack it for you. In verse 6, we encounter again this man clothed in linen. We encountered him before, back in chapter 10, verse 5. And we said, when we were looking at chapter 10, that this figure is none other than God himself. You may remember that Daniel there in chapter 10 was quite dismantled by the sight of him, so much so indeed that it took him really the rest of the chapter to recover from the experience. And we said too that being confronted by the glory of God like that there in chapter 10, it was timely for Daniel. Daniel was about to hear more about this frightening character we've talked about so often, King Antiochus the Fourth, and the havoc that he would wreak on the people of God a few centuries later on. The stuff of nightmares, really, which would doubtless have plunged Daniel into despair were it not for this preceding encounter with God himself. And that encounter then with God himself, it cut Antiochus down to size. It put Antiochus into perspective. Viewed by himself, this Greek king might have appeared heart-stoppingly terrifying. Viewed alongside this majestic divine figure, however, he appeared much less so. And I'm saying then it's the same divine figure that reappears now in our passage. It's interesting that Daniel sees him here above the waters of the stream, verse 6. Presumably these are the same waters as there in chapter 10 and verse 4. There we have the word river used here, the word stream, but I don't think we should make too much of that distinction because the two Hebrew words are pretty much interchangeable. But what is more telling is that the adjective great is now dropped. So in chapter 10, verse 4, Daniel was standing on the bank of the great river. That adjective is now dropped in chapter 12, verse 6, as indeed is the identification of the river as the Tigris, which of course then as now was known for its impressiveness as a great river. And those two omissions then, the omission of the adjective great and the omission of the name, the Tigris, they do seem to indicate a downscaling of this river as we move from chapter 10, verse 4 to chapter 12, verse 6, which raises the question, why? Why is the mighty Tigris suddenly quite a bit smaller, it seems, here in our passage? Well, I think the answer is because the man clothed in linen, this divine figure, is hovering above the river somehow. And next to him then, it no longer appears this great flow of water that everyone knew the Tigris to be. It's put into a new perspective alongside this great divine figure. And on a couple of occasions in this book of Daniel, actually, Antiochus, interestingly, is described using water imagery. So in chapter 9, verse 26, he's described as being a flood, coming in like a flood. And then in chapter 11, verse 40, he's said to overflow. And it may well be then that this river here in chapter 10 verse 6 is perhaps meant to stand for Antiochus. And as it becomes small alongside God, again we're perhaps meant to see Antiochus becoming small alongside God. I know I've pushed this point several times then in the latter stages of this series, but we can't stress it too often that this is how we shall avoid being phased in years to come, however big and aggressive the enemies of Christ and the gospel may become in our land. We shall avoid being phased by keeping ourselves well acquainted with the glory and majesty of God. Because alongside the glory and majesty of God, these enemies won't appear so big and aggressive after all. They will appear less like mighty rivers and more like trickling streams. Anyway, here in verse 6, this divine figure then, he's asked a question. How long shall it be till the end of these wonders? Now, wonders doesn't have to have a positive sense. It can just mean things that take your breath away, whether in a good way or in a bad way. And here then, again, probably a reference to what Antiochus was going to do, the havoc he was going to wreak on the people of God. And the question then, how long shall it be till the end of these wonders, means once they've begun, how long shall it be till the end of them? In other words, how long will they last? What will be the duration of all this persecution that Antiochus is going to inflict? And in his response in verse 7, we actually have further confirmation, don't we, that this man clothed in linen is more than an angel. He isn't just Gabriel or someone. He is divine. Because notice he doesn't simply, in response to the question, impart information, does he? Oh, it will last this long. No, he swears that it will last this long. In other words, he doesn't just know the duration of Antiochus's persecution. He decides the duration of Antiochus's persecution. I swear it will be this long. Another confirmation, as I say, that we're dealing here with God himself. And what are we to make then of what he does say about the duration of this very troubled period for God's people that's coming a few centuries later? Is it good news or is it bad news what he says about the duration? Well, certainly the first part of what he says has a moderately positive feel, doesn't it? So he swore that it would be for a time, times and half a time. It would be for a definite period, in other words, with an end point. It wouldn't just go on indefinitely and open-endedly. No, this period of great trouble, great persecution, great unrest, great affliction, great suffering, it would last for a definite, contained period. So the first part of what he says has a moderately positive feel. The second part of what he says, however, is more sobering. He says, and that when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, all these things will be finished. In other words, it will last as long as it takes for the power of God's people to be shattered. Only when the power of God's people has been shattered, only then will this affliction be lifted and will Antiochus be stopped. That's what's being said. And I think that brings us then to my first heading, the meaning of Daniel's question. What is the meaning of this question in verse 8? O Lord, what shall be the outcome of these things? Well, I think Daniel here, having heard that not until the power of God's people has been shattered will this persecution end, having heard that, Daniel is worried, greatly worried, that perhaps God is indicating here that his people are going to be wiped out altogether. That his people are going to be no more. That what others in the past, like Pharaoh and Balaam and others, have been unable to do, Antiochus will succeed in doing. He will just wipe out God's people. He will terminate them. He will liquidate them. He will remove them from the planet. Daniel, I think, is worried about that. And so when he asks, what shall be the outcome of these things, he's asking, is there a future then for the people of God? If Antiochus is going to persecute until their power has been shattered, is there any future for them? Well, just before we move on, I do want to pause for a moment on that idea then of the power of God's holy people being shattered. It echoes Deuteronomy chapter 32. You might want to just turn there for a moment. In Deuteronomy 32, we have what is described, I think, in the ESV as a song of Moses. And it's an interesting song that kind of sets out in broad brushstrokes what Israel's future is going to look like in the ensuing centuries, and how then Israel would go after idols. Look at verses 15 to 18. Jeshurun, that's a kind of nickname for Israel, grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, stout, and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and scoffed at the rock of his salvation. They stirred him to jealousy with strange gods, with abominations. They provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known, to new gods that had come recently, whom your fathers had never dreaded. You were unmindful of the rock that bore you, and you forgot the God who gave you birth. And so Israel would go after idols in this way. And Yahweh would then send enemies against them, and that's described in the next verses. But eventually we come to verse 36 of Deuteronomy 32, where we read this: the Lord will vindicate his people. So after their enemies have been able to trample on them, the Lord will eventually vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants when he sees that their power is gone. Then he will have compassion. And what does that mean in Deuteronomy 32? What does it mean that their power is finally gone? Well, look at how he continues in verse 37. Then he, that is God, will say, where are their gods, the rock in which they took refuge, who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offering? Let them rise up and help you. Let them be your protection. In other words, then, Israel's power being gone means their reliance upon idols being gone. Once they've stopped relying on their idols, and Yahweh sees that, then he will step in and vindicate his people and have compassion on them. And I think we have the same meaning then here in chapter 12 and verse 7, the power of the holy people coming to an end. You see, remember the reason for this whole dark era in the history of God's people, from the Babylonian invasion that we touched on this morning, the destruction of Jerusalem, all the way through the Persian oppression and through the Greek oppression, climaxing, culminating in Antiochus. The reason for it all is what? It's Israel's idolatry, isn't it? The fact that Israel has just persistently, again and again, under king after king after king, gone after idols. And God seems to be saying here in Daniel 12:7 that Nebuchadnezzar's oppression and afflictions will not be enough to quite break Israel's dependence on idols. And then the Persians will come, and their oppression, that will not quite be enough to really break my people's dependence upon idols. It's only once this monster comes, only once Antiochus comes and inflicts suffering like they've never experienced before, only then will finally their power be shattered, finally their reliance on their idols be finished. And then I will be able to stop the suffering and the persecution. And this principle then, of God having to shatter his people's idolatrous dependencies, it still applies, doesn't it? It applies at the individual level as well as at the corporate level we're talking about here with God's Old Testament people. I mean, John Newton felt it keenly, didn't he, in that hymn that we have just sung. "Will you pursue your worm to death?" he was forced to cry out. As God went to great lengths to break his schemes of earthly joy, to shatter his power, shatter his reliance upon self, upon idols, upon created realities, upon anything but God. It's interesting that this verse does use this phrase, this label, the holy people. And I suppose we think of that label in perhaps holy, sorry, the pun there, the holy positive terms. So to be God's holy people is to be God's set apart people, God's special people, to receive special treatment from God. And that's true. Special treatment in the sense of promises and blessings and entitlements, yes, but to be God's holy people is also to receive special treatment in the sense of jealous discipline. And that's the same for us then. We have a God who regards us as too special, too holy, too set apart to leave us comfortable in our idolatrous dependencies. A God who will sometimes go to significant and painful lengths to shatter our power, to break our earthly schemes of joy. And it's not a pleasant reality. But it's vastly better, is it not, than the alternative, a God who just shrugs his shoulders and walks away. So the meaning of the question, Daniel is asking, what will be left? What will be left of your people when you, through Antiochus, shatter their power? The meaning of the question. And then secondly, the answer to the question. The answer to the question. And the answer comes in verses 10 to 12. And the answer is then that God is not going to allow his people to be terminated. They're not going to be wiped off the face of the planet, as Daniel perhaps is fearing. No, God will maintain his holy people through Antiochus's persecutions. It's true, we read that some, verse 10, will act wickedly, that some of God's people, some will apostatize, some will desert the living and true God amidst the suffering. But not all, others will flourish. And we're not going to linger on verse 10 because you'll perhaps recognize it's pretty much repeating what we saw last time in chapter 11, verse 35. But there is an interesting new emphasis when you move into verses 11 and 12. So these wise ones, these ones who would flourish amidst Antiochus' persecutions, those of God's people who would grow holier through it. These wise ones, yes, they would grow in purity, but we're told something else about them there in verse 12. They would also wait. Blessed is he who waits. That is, they would wait for the whole thing to end. Not very spectacular, that, is it? It's not rocket science, but Daniel has been told that there will be those who, through the darkness of that dreadful period, they will wait. They will wait for it to end. There's this puzzling numerical discrepancy you'll notice in verses 11 and 12. Probably we're meant to understand that the 1,290 days is the duration of the persecution. The 1,335 days is probably how long it will seem to these wise saints who are waiting for it to end. Just like some of you probably go home convinced that I preached for well over 50 minutes when really it's just been 45. These guys would be convinced that it had gone on for much longer than it actually had done. And so this waiting, it isn't easy, but there will be those who will do it. There will be those, Daniel's been told, who will wait. And even though it just seems to be going on forever, they will wait, and they will wait, and they will wait. You see, it's great, isn't it, that we live in a context this evening where Asher's Bakery can be convicted of discrimination, and then they can appeal that, and the conviction can be overturned. It's great we live in a context where legislation about education can be proposed, removing the right to disagree with same-sex marriage, and then there can be protests and there can be a U-turn on that. All of that is great. But you see, these faithful Jews in Antiochus's time, they wouldn't enjoy those privileges. They wouldn't be able to take Antiochus Epiphanes to court for what he was doing. They wouldn't be able to launch some official protest against this persecution. For they wouldn't be able to assert their rights of religious freedom. No, they wouldn't be able to do anything except wait. That's all they would be able to do, wait until God's time comes and the persecution ends. James's readers, there in James chapter 5, are in the same boat, aren't they? There they are, and they're being discriminated against by these rich people who are making them work for so little in their fields. And these Christians, they can't call in the Christian Institute in this situation. They have no legal recourse here. What does James tell them they can do? What wonderful alternatives does he give them? Wait. Be patient. Like a farmer waiting for the rain. Just wait. 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 That word patience used so many times there in that passage. And it's the situation, isn't it, of our brothers and sisters in so many parts of the world. In North Korea, nothing they can do about the persecution they're facing. Our Christian brothers and sisters in Iran, in Eritrea, in China, little that they can do through the courts or anything official like that. Just wait. And of course, for James's readers, it's not waiting for a time, times and half a time. It's not waiting for a point within history. It's waiting for what? The Lord's coming. James doesn't give them some promise that, look, it'll only be 3.5 years. It will only be 1290 days. It will only be this contained historical period. No, wait for Jesus to come. That's when relief will arrive. When the Lord comes. And perhaps then the days are coming when more and more this will be our situation as well. Perhaps this window in which we can fight discrimination through the courts is a window that one day will close. And when that day comes, I said, we'll need a big view of God to sustain us in dark days. But we'll also need a big view of the second coming of Jesus Christ to sustain us in those days, to keep us waiting and waiting and waiting, knowing this won't be forever, that relief is on its way, and the heavens are going to part, and the Saviour who ascended on the Mount of Olives is going to return in power and in glory, and all his enemies will recoil from him as he comes in that manner. And we shall be rewarded. Waiting, waiting, waiting. So the meaning of the question, the answer to the question. But then thirdly, notice with me here, the danger in the question. The danger in the question. So Daniel wants to know then the outcome of Antiochus's persecutions for the people of God. And he is given an answer, as we've just seen. But I think it's fair to say the answer he's given is fairly limited, isn't it? I mean, mainly, as I said a moment ago, it's just a repetition of chapter 11, verse 35. Daniel isn't given much here in response to his question. And in fact, I would go further than that and say there's a slight sense, it seems to me, of Daniel here being put in his place, of this divine figure detecting danger in the question and perhaps rebuffing is too strong, but to some degree, as I say, just putting Daniel in his place as he asks this question. I mean, for one thing, verse 9, this divine figure seems to be saying, when he says the words are shut up and sealed until the time of the end, he seems to be saying, no more revelation now, Daniel. The revelation's finished. It's closed now. I'm not giving you any more. And then you go to the last verse, verse 13, and it seems to me to be almost a Peter moment. Do you remember Peter at the end of John's Gospel? And he's denied his Saviour those three times in the high priest's courtyard. And now Jesus has died. And now Jesus has risen again. And now the two encounter each other on that beach. And remember how after breakfast, Jesus and Peter have that conversation. And, do you love me? Three times. And he reinstates Peter, doesn't he, to Christian service. Feed my sheep. And then you remember how he indicates to Peter what his future holds and how he's going to die, the death by which he will glorify God. And Peter listens. And then do you remember Peter's old impulsiveness coming through again? He turns around and John's following. But Lord, what about him? And Jesus says, basically, mind your own business, Peter. You follow me. What does it matter what the future holds for him? You don't need to know that. You've been too curious. You've been too inquisitive. You just follow me. And in verse 13 here, God seems to be saying to Daniel, Daniel, yes, I wanted you to be a channel of a good deal of future revelation, all this future revelation that has unfolded in the last few chapters of the book. But Daniel, I don't want you to slip into an unhealthy fascination with the future. It's time now for you to refocus on the present. And it's always a danger, isn't it, for us as Christians, that we can slip into unhealthy fascinations. We can become absorbed by things peripherally related to Christianity, but things that are just speculative and nebulous. And we lose sight of the simple basics of the Christian life. I love the way that Psalm 73 ends. And just the sheer simplicity of the contours of the life of faith as they come across there. Verses 23 and 24. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterwards you will receive me into glory. Simple as that. That's the life of faith. That's its contours. Continually with you. My right hand being held. Guided. Afterwards taken into glory. And verse 13 here in our passage seems to me to have a similar feel. And here then it's as if Daniel, his gaze is suddenly now redirected from all these future horizons. In the 2nd century BC, when this Greek king is going to step onto the stage of history, that's where Daniel's gaze has been over the last few chapters. And now Daniel's gaze is shifted away from those horizons to three much more basic horizons. Let's just close with those then. First of all, the immediate horizon for Daniel. The immediate horizon. Go your way till the end. And the end there, I think, is simply the end of your life, Daniel. Go your way is a bit of a loose translation. It's just go, actually. Go till the end. But I think Go Your Way probably captures what is meant. In other words, Daniel is being told there, just carry on living faithfully, day after day, doing your ordinary job here in Babylon, serving your boss in the office. Just get on with it, Daniel. Get up each morning, go into work, do your stuff, come home, go to bed, get up again the next morning, and just get on with that. And that's what I want you to focus on, Daniel. I want you to put aside now all this fancy stuff about future kings, and just make sure you keep on putting one step in front of the other, living properly with integrity day after day. And there's a lesson for us all there, isn't there? I love 1 Thessalonians 4:11. I think this is the NIV's translation. Make it your ambition, Paul says. How would you finish that? Make it your ambition, what? To go and change the world? No, Paul says, make it your ambition to live a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your hands, just as we told you. It's not very glamorous or spectacular, is it? Lead a quiet life, mind your own business, work with your hands. And that's what Daniel's been told here. Daniel, don't get lost in all this stuff I've been telling you. Just get on. Lead a quiet life, mind your own business, work with your hands. That's your duty this week, and next week, and the week after, until the end, until your end, until you die. Your duty probably isn't to go and change the world, probably isn't to do something explosive that will cause books to be written about you in the future. Perhaps it will, but probably not. Your duty is just to quietly glorify God as a child at school, as a mother in the house, changing nappies, doing the dishes, as an employee, as an employer, as a sports person, in your recreational hours, whatever you're doing, just carrying on, living quietly for the glory of Jesus Christ. The immediate horizon for Daniel, and then the intermediate horizon for Daniel. And you shall rest, God says. Corresponds, I think, to verse 2 of this chapter. Those who sleep in the dust. So God is saying, after you've lived faithfully, quietly, till the end of your days, then you'll rest. You'll rest. And that probably is what we shall do as well. We may not, because Christ may come first. We hope that will be the case. But if he doesn't, then you and I, we shall rest. And death is for everyone, including us Christians, a deeply unnatural thing, not something that we should relish for itself. But it's not something to be feared. It's resting. In Paul's terms, it's falling asleep in Jesus. Remember that great vision John has in Revelation 6 of the martyrs. The Christian martyrs who are now in heaven. And it's interesting for all sorts of reasons. It's interesting because these guys, they're in heaven, but they're not yet perfectly blessed and happy because they're crying, Sovereign Lord, how long? Even people in heaven, you know, this very minute are crying, how long? They're not saying, this is everything. They're saying, how long? People in heaven are doing that. But they were given, each of them, a white robe, Revelation 6:11, and told to rest a little longer. They're resting. It's comforting, isn't it, when we think of believers we know who perhaps once sat in these seats and have departed this earth. They're resting with Jesus. And we, if we die before he comes, we shall rest with him. Death is nothing to be feared. It's laying down in rest, just like you will do tonight when you go home and you will lie in your bed. Death is that on a different level, resting with Jesus. So the immediate horizon for Daniel, the intermediate horizon for Daniel, and then the ultimate horizon for Daniel. And you shall stand in your allotted place at the end of the days. Not now the end of your life, now the end of the days. That's the ultimate horizon. And two terms there which have lots of associations in the Old Testament, and two terms indeed which have associations particularly with the promised land. So you shall stand. I began our service tonight reading from Psalm 122, and the writer David there talking about going to the house of the Lord and our feet standing in Jerusalem. It's the same Hebrew word that we have here. And we have that idea then, this word standing, which is in that well-known psalm connected with Jerusalem, the city of God, the city where God dwells. And then this word allotted place or allotment. It's used in the book of Joshua at the beginning of three consecutive chapters, at the beginning of chapter 15, at the beginning of chapter 16, and at the beginning of chapter 17. Allotments for the different tribes in the promised land, the allotment for the tribe of Judah, the allotment for the people of Joseph, the allotment for the people of Manasseh. And so this word, it was used of a tribal allotment within the promised land. Now think of Daniel here. And he's a man who loves the promised land, doesn't he? He's a man who loves Jerusalem. Remember how he prays when he gets ensnared by his enemies. He's praying toward Jerusalem, isn't he? Or you think of his own prayer in chapter 9, where he prays for Jerusalem and that the Lord would restore the city. He loves Jerusalem. He loves the promised land, but of course his feet will never stand on the promised land again. He will die in Babylon. And he will never have an allotment, an allotted place in the promised land, because he will die in Babylon. But here, God is showing him his ultimate horizon. And he's saying, your feet will stand in a better Jerusalem than that little city there in the Middle East. And you will have an allotment in a better land than that little piece of real estate in the Middle East. Your feet will stand in the true Jerusalem. You're marching to Zion. And you will have an allotment in the ultimate promised land, the new heavens and the new earth. And that's our ultimate horizon too, if we're Christians. Tomorrow, we carry on living faithfully amidst the quietness of our ordinary lives. In a few years' time, we shall rest in our graves, but our souls resting with Jesus. But ultimately, when he comes, we shall arrive in the ultimate Mount Zion, where we shall worship God in festive scenes like Israel never knew, even in their greatest festivals. And we shall have an allotment in a world that is free from the curse, free from death, free from all that's nasty. You can't beat being a Christian, can you? To have these horizons, these three horizons, what could be better? Let's focus on them. Let's seek to learn more and more of what the complicated bits of Daniel mean, yes. But let's not get too lost in speculation. Let's look to tomorrow and to resting with Jesus and to Jesus coming on the last day. Amen.